Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Ukraine is not yet dead, nor its glory and freedom, goes the first line of an 1862 poem written by Pavlo Chubinsky. At the time, half the country belonged to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, half to Imperial Russia. But Chubinsky's poem was later paired with a musical score, and in 1917, for a brief 3 years, it became the anthem of an independent Ukraine. In 1920, Ukraine was made part of the Soviet Union. The anthem was officially discouraged, and under Moscow's rule, millions died in successive wars, enforced famines, and gulags. But ever since the Maidan protests of 2013 and 2014 and Russia's invasion of Ukrainian land, Ukrainians say this time their nation is very much alive. You're hearing sound of protesters singing the national anthem in Kyiv's Maidan Square. They talk of building a Western-style democracy, even as tensions now rise about another potential Russian invasion. There's a new sense of Ukrainian identity that's maturing. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're going to take a look at what it feels like to be Ukrainian now. And joining us is Vitaly Chernetsky. He was born and raised in the eastern Ukrainian city of Odessa. He's now a professor of Slavic languages and literature at the University of Kansas. Professor Chernetsky, welcome to you.
Hello.
Also with us today from New Haven, Connecticut, Timothy Snyder. He's a professor of history at Yale and the author of many books on Russian, Ukrainian, and Eastern European history, such as Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. He's also author of On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Professor Snyder, welcome back to On Point.
Glad to be with you.
So I'd actually like to start by going back into that history that we just touched upon in the introduction to the show. So, Professor Chernetsky, take us back to what you think is sort of the most important first stage of Ukraine's history that helps us understand what's going on now.
Well, Ukraine as an entity in our modern understanding, like all nations, is a product of the last 200 plus years, but of course it has deep historical roots that go more than 1,000 years. However, it is the understanding of what it means for a nation as an imagined community, as what scholars call that, is the idea of people sharing an understanding of what it means to be Ukrainian, that started forming in the mid of the 19th century, accelerated gradually, and so by the beginning of the 20th century, we see a very serious movement towards cultural autonomy and independence. And within the revolution of 1917, the first part of it, the end of monarchy in Russia after February, we have an autonomous Ukraine come into being and very rapidly trying to figure out what it was. And then the Soviet period freezes it because it has sort of these boxes that all the ethnic groups are fit in. And it's after the collapse of the Soviet Union that we have a new sense of now Ukraine figuring out for all the people in the now independent country called Ukraine how they can come together and be one.
Okay, so that's sort of the four major points, roughly, that you just described there. Professor Snyder, just jump in here and add to that. I'm still compelled to better understand, for example, what was Ukrainian identity when that poem by Chubinsky was written in 1862?
I think one way to understand Ukrainian history is to imagine that Ukraine is a very normal country, just more so. That is to say that Ukraine passes through stages that are very familiar to us in European history generally, but at some points those passages are turned out to be much more difficult or in the 20th century much more violent. So, I mean, as Professor Chernetsky says, in the 19th century, there is a actually quite typical Ukrainian national movement. It begins in the early 19th century, I would say, in Kharkiv, in what's now eastern Ukraine. And over the course of the 19th century, largely as a result of Russian prohibitions on the use of the Ukrainian language, it ends up landing in what's now western Ukraine, around the city of Lviv, which is in the Habsburg monarchy. The notion of what Ukraine is has to do with the Ukrainian people. So at the time, history was very often written in terms of states and empires. But what national movements did was they shifted the discourse to society, to culture, to the people themselves. The most important Ukrainian historian, Mykhailo Hrushevsky, wrote the history of Ukraine as a history of the Ukrainian people. You know, something which we now take for granted. We take for granted that social history is normal, is actually pioneered by these national movements. So in the late 19th century, there wouldn't have been a clear notion of where the Ukrainian borders are, but the notion was that there was a Ukrainian people which was deserving of the same kinds of political rights that other peoples would deserve.
I see. So that's a really important point. Professor Chernetsky, let me turn back to you here, because when Professor Snyder just said there wouldn't be a clear notion of where Ukrainian borders were, but there's a clear notion of who the Ukrainian people are. To the first point of that, I mean, I think the lack of the clear notion of where the borders were in the late 19th century, to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the kind of mentality that, say, Russian President Vladimir Putin puts forward today in 2022, as you know, in years past, I believe I've heard him even say that he doesn't believe Ukraine is even a country.
Yes, this is one of the problems in the understanding of these groups. But here, Ukrainians are not very different from, instance, the Czechs, in that Prague was a German-speaking city, and many cities of Ukraine in the late 19th, early 20th century, too, you could hear German or Russian or Polish spoken of very much so. There was a pressure of with assimilation and with the elevation in the social hierarchy within the two empires to adopt the dominant identity. And so just like, say, the Czechs were associated with the rural, you know, peasantry, but they were the overwhelming majority of the population. Similar case is in Ukraine. These cities were surrounded by the sea, which was entirely Ukrainian in culture and understanding, the sea meaning of people. But the urban centers, if you just looked at those, that would have been less obvious. And this is where one of the challenges was.
Uh-huh. Do you know, Professor Chernetsky, I wonder if you mind if we just see how this has flowed through your life as an individual, as a Ukrainian. So, I mean, growing up in Odessa, or maybe even when you first left Ukraine, how would you know, like, you know, how would you identify a fellow Ukrainian? What are the commonalities there that created this this identity that we're talking about?
Well, yes, I come up from a city, come from the city which is very multicultural, very diverse in terms of ethnic backgrounds. I too have at least four or five that I can trace in my family. And this is something that was not necessarily conscious as a child, but traveling outside the city, it was often a revelation for me. I remember the first time visiting a Russian village outside Moscow and hearing grannies speak Russian. To me, grannies in the village were supposed to speak Ukrainian because that's the childhood experience that I had, even though in the city I heard Russian spoken much more frequently. My parents consciously switched to speaking Russian in the late 50s, early 1960s because of the pressures of education. This was a time of another Russification campaign under Khrushchev in the Soviet Union. And for me, it was graduating high school and moving to Moscow. I graduated high school in 86, the year of the Chernobyl accident, and I originally planned to go to university in Kyiv, but Chernobyl made that a little worrisome. So I tried applying to Moscow State University, got in, and there I was felt othered. I felt multiply othered, and in full accordance to post-colonial theory, it was the displacement to the imperial center that helped me become a more conscious Ukrainian.
Uh-huh. Timothy Snyder, what do you hear in Vitaly's story there?
Well, there's a very important element there, which is in a way the second part of the story that I was beginning to tell. Because if in the 19th century the main step that national liberation movements made was to try to identify the people as against the state, that is, try to identify the people who are underprivileged, the people who are perhaps the peasantry, the people who are the laborers, the people who are not necessarily in the imperial centers. The next step after that, which roughly speaking comes in the late 19th, early 20th century, is the step that Vitaly Chernitsky is talking about, which is identifying how you make your way into the nation. So maybe that granny in the countryside is unproblematically Ukrainian because she speaks Ukrainian, but that's not the end of the story. Mm-hmm. The story of the territory of Ukraine, like the story of the territory of Eastern Europe and for that matter most of the world, is multilingual. And many of the people who decide to become the leaders of Ukrainian movement in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, and then also moving on to today, are people who have complex backgrounds.
Yeah.
So, for example, Andrei Sheptytsky, the most important religious leader of Ukraine at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries, came from a Polish-speaking family. Hrushevsky, who wrote Ukrainian histories, had a mother who was Polish. The most important Ukrainian activists in the 20s and 30s, or some of them, were a family called the Rudnitsky, a composer, a journalist, a politician, a literary critic. Of their four grandparents, two were Jewish, one was a Polish-speaking German, and one was Ukrainian. And nevertheless, they did a tremendous amount to form what the Ukrainian nation was. Mm. In other words, in the 20th century, you have this idea of a political nation, a civic nation, where the important people in politics and culture are making a choice.
Yeah. Well, Timothy Snyder and Vitaly Chernetsky, stand by here for a second, because we're trying to understand what Ukrainian identity is now also, given this history that we're talking about. And we'll hear a lot more about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we're trying to understand what Ukrainian identity is now, what it means to be Ukrainian. And in a few minutes, we'll hear from a journalist in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv. But right now, I'm joined by Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale and author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, and also author of On Tyranny as well. And Vitaly Chernetsky joins us as well. He's a professor of Slavic languages and literature at the University of Kansas, born and bred in the Ukrainian city of Odessa, author of the forthcoming Spaces of Glocalization, Studies in Ukrainian Literature and Cinema. And I really appreciated the journey that you helped us take through 19th century, specifically Ukrainian history. But I want to spend a couple of minutes with both of you talking more specifically about the first half of the 20th century, because I think it's important in understanding how Ukrainians are thinking about their country today. So, Professor Chernetsky, again, I'm wondering if you might give us that first-person experience. What happened to your family, particularly in the Second World War?
My family, in many ways, was typical to Ukrainian families, more generally, in that I have relatives who suffered through Holodomor, the terror famine, Stalin manufactured famine of 1932-33. In the family were Jewish relatives by marriage who perished in the Holocaust. Both my grandparents were Soviet soldiers who luckily survived through the war. In the family were also family members who were arrested and taken to the Gulag. All those horrors, all those traumatic experiences left their mark and made people very worried about how to present themselves publicly. So there was private and public presentation of the self, but privately there were stories there. So I grew up with two of my grandparents who were still living, imparting for me my Ukrainian identity through Ukrainian fairy tales, Ukrainian songs, telling about their childhoods through the foods they cooked. So that to me was an unproblematic aspect of identity that I absorbed. But this is part of the, I guess, the conundrum that a lot of Ukrainians held historically. What is your private identity for family, personal use, and what is the public identity that you project to the world?
Mm. Timothy Snyder, help us get a deeper understanding of here of what happened to Ukrainians and in Ukraine during that period from basically the early 30s to 1945.
So like I say, the landmarks are all familiar, but the experiences tend to be more intense. If I could back up just a tiny bit more, the First World War, the end of the First World War is a period of the end of empire and of revolution all across Central and Eastern Europe. This is true for Ukraine as well. There are not one but two quite serious attempts to establish a Ukrainian state. A lot of people suffer and die for the Ukrainian cause, although it fails. And this is very important because we should just remember that a century ago, everybody knew there was a Ukrainian nation. Lenin knew there was a Ukrainian nation. Stalin knew there was a Ukrainian nation. They might have thought that it was a problem, but they had no doubt about its existence, which is why the Soviet Union is formed the way it is with different national republics, including a Ukrainian one. But that Ukrainian republic within the Soviet Union is in a special position. When Stalin wants to modernize the country to create an industrial superpower on the basis of what had been an agrarian empire, Ukraine is at the center of all of that. Mm-hmm. Ukraine has the most fertile territory in Europe, among the most fertile territory in the world, and it is deliberately exploited and then politically targeted, as Vitaly already mentioned, in a famine which kills about 4 million people, the greatest humanitarian disaster in Europe up until that point anyway in the 20th century. Then during the Second World War, Ukraine is the specific target of Hitler's ambitions. Hitler wants that fertile territory. The Second World War, in an important sense, is all about Ukraine. And the Nazi assault on the Soviet Union is chiefly about getting control of Ukraine. So the sum total of all of this is that between 1933 and 1945, the time when both Hitler and Stalin were in power, more people are killed in Ukraine than in any other country in the world.
Wow. Okay. I mean, there's so much we could talk about, so much in just that span of time that you both took us through. But I want to push forward here a little bit because Professor Chernetsky, you said a particular name earlier, which deserves more attention, because the Ukraine under Soviet control all the way up until the early 90s. But in that time, there's the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. Can you talk to me about that as a Ukrainian?
Yes, absolutely. I have very vivid memories. These were my final months of high school, and the shock that all of us experienced, not knowing as the news was gradually, very slowly unfolded and presented to us. It was a big shock and a big trauma for all people in Ukraine, because it gave us very clear understanding that the system, the Soviet system, for all of its talk about being a socialist country representing the interests of the people, did not care about people. And this is one of those main events that pushed Ukrainians towards a stronger sense of self, but it is a traumatic one, which is why Yuri Andruhovich, one of Ukraine's leading contemporary writers, famously said is that our independence arrived with a bitter taste of the apocalyptic, because the Chernobyl catastrophe was very much on the mind of the pro-independence activists in the final years of the Soviet Union's existence.
Well, but Vitaly, can I ask you, that line is so powerful, that Ukrainian independence arrived with the bitter taste of the apocalyptic. I mean, what does that mean to you personally? Yeah,
it meant that Ukraine was in a precarious situation, but it was in a precarious situation for much of its modern history. There was a great sense of hope, but also a sense that it was a tenuousness of that situation of hope. What has happened in the last 30 years of newly independent Ukraine is that we see, sometimes paradoxically, unexpectedly for both internal and external observers, that sense of is getting stronger, is getting more confident, and therefore we do have now this very strong and established a sense of a new Ukrainian identity that we're talking about today. Mm.
Well, Professor Chernetsky and Professor Snyder, hang on here for just a minute, because I'd like to introduce Sevgil Musaeva into the conversation. She's editor of the online daily Ukrainska Pravda. She's also co-founder of Crimea SOS, which is helping more than 200,000 Crimeans who fled the Russian invasion of 2014, helping them resettle. Sevgil, welcome to On Point.
Hello, nice to hear you all. Hello, Magna. Hello, Vitaly. Hello, Timothy Snyder. And here I want to mention that I'm a big fan of Timothy Snyder, and I'm happy to be with him today and with all us.
Well, we're very glad to be able to bring you all together here. And I should say that you're joining us from the capital, Ukrainian capital of Kyiv. But Sevgil, you are a member of the Tatar minority in Crimea. So so let's talk a little bit about what the Soviet invasion of Crimea did to you, your family, your homeland. Tell me about that.
Yes, and here I want to start the point about political nation, because I'm not Ukrainian ethnically, but it's my choice. And you know that here we talk about history, and the history of my nation is also tragic, because by the order of Stalin, a year before the end of the Second World War, in May 1944, all the representatives of my nation, Crimean Tatars, were deported from the Crimean Peninsula to Uzbekistan. And they were accused of collaborating with occupiers, and Stalin expelled more than 200,000 people from Crimea. And for more than 50 years, the Crimean Tatars were forbidden to live in Crimea. And I was able to return to my homeland in the beginning of 90s, when I was actually 2.5 years old, and my sister was just 6 months old, and my family moved from Uzbekistan to Crimea. And year after, my parents voted for Ukrainian independence during the referendum. And it was a choice. And I grew up in Crimea, and it was pro-Russian, absolutely pro-Russian region during this time. Not even pro-Russian, it was post-Soviet region with all problems. I mean, with language, with very strange myths about Crimean Tatars. We were like enemies of the people. And in 2014, unfortunately, we faced with occupation of Crimea, and all of us reminded all this trauma and all this pain of that we lost our motherland second time in our history, the history of our nation.
I see.
And
Well, Sevgil, hold on here for just a second, because I just want to turn back to Timothy Snyder for a moment. And Tim Snyder, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what the Crimean part of this story, how it informs this discussion about Ukrainian identity today.
Well, I mean, Crimea was a part of the Ukrainian Soviet Republic, and Crimea was part of Ukraine. Therefore, when Ukraine left the Soviet Union in 1991, the history of the Crimean Tatars is a particularly touching part of the history of independent Ukraine, because the Tatars who were allowed to return are returning not to a Soviet Union from which they've been expelled brutally in the mid-1940s, but they're returning to an independent Ukraine. And so the Crimean Tatar rebirth is also part of the history of the rebirth of Ukraine. And so, as Savil has already suggested, the particular place that Crimean Tatars now occupy in contemporary Ukraine is of a group that has experienced Ukrainian history with particular intensity. And then in many important cases, it's really striking how many Crimean Tatars are visible in public life, right? We're speaking to an excellent representative of that right now. In many fields of life, Crimean Tatars then serve as a kind of face of Ukraine. This refugee experience of theirs being in a way hypertypical of the experience of many Ukrainians right now. I mean, there are about 2 million internally displaced people because of the Russian invasion of 2014. But the fate of the Crimean Tatars is particularly sharp and poignant.
Mm. So, Savil, then tell me more about how would you describe what your Ukrainian identity is today, then?
Okay, thank you. Thank you for this question. My personal opinion, Ukrainians and Crimean Tatars have a lot of common in their history, and it's a part of our common identity. So because both nations faced on attempts from Russian Empire and Soviet Union to destroy part of nation, language, culture, Crimean Tatars and Ukrainians were trying to preserve culture and language literally for the centuries, it's true. And both in 21st century faced with a new wave for this Russian aggression. And now our main goal for all Crimean Tatars is to live in our motherland, and Crimea is the main core of our identity. And it also became very clear point of Ukrainian nation as well. So for me, it's my choice to be a part of this political nation. I truly support what's going on now, for example, with reforms, with everything. Mm. And also I want to focus on democracy, and democracy is a choice of Crimean Tatars as well, because Timothy mentioned that, and Crimean Tatars in Crimea, in occupied Crimea, now became a target of Russian by Russia, because they support Ukraine, as they don't support Russia. A lot of people left, and they left Crimea just because they voted for Ukraine, and they support Ukrainian legacy in Crimea.
Okay. So let me turn back to Vitaly Chernetsky then. Professor Chernetsky, Savigil said a lot of interesting things just then, and I want to pick up on one in particular. She mentioned language. Now, I'm seeing reports. I mean, I'm sitting here in the United States, so I'm going to lean on all of you to be sure to keep us on the right track here. But I'm seeing reports that that recently you might hear Ukrainian language being spoke there more often than you would have in years past, where the most common the sort of public language was Russian. Do I have that right?
Yes, you are correct. I would say that there was a push gradual to do this, but there was resistance for a while in many sectors of cultural sectors. For instance, most of the print media, even in the during period of independence, was in Russian. But things have really radically changed recently. We see that, and I observe that, you know, when I was last in Ukraine this summer, visiting family and friends in July and August, a lot more effort, even in historically much more Russified cities like my native city of Odessa, of people making an effort, even at a supermarket, speaking to each other in Ukrainian. And in other public situations, a lot of the glossy magazines have just deliberately switched from Russian to Ukrainian, the ones published in Ukraine. So we see a lot of those changes. A lot of public intellectuals, for instance, some of the writers who used to write in Russian from the historically more Russified parts of the country have now become bilingual writers. They consciously made effort to right in Ukrainian. In some case, it would be displaced writers from the now Russian-controlled Donbass region, like Volodymyr Rafeyenko or Iye Kiva, or from my native city of Odessa, Boris Khersonsky, who is Jewish in terms of his cultural background, an outstanding Russian language poet who has also started writing in Ukrainian, self-translating in Ukrainian. And in general, he and others, like I've mentioned, are making much more of an effort to become part of this unified community of people of Ukrainian culture.
Well, you know, it seems to me to be this is a remarkable point, because as you said, this is all happening in the past less than a decade, whereas it wasn't that long ago in people's living memory that asserting that kind of Ukrainian identity or language could have led people to be, you know, sent to labor, to Soviet labor camps. So I'd like the three of you to just hang in here with me for another minute. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk a lot more about how asserting Ukrainian identity today is playing out with the tensions between Ukraine, Russia, and the rest of the West. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I just want to give you a preview of what we're going to be talking about tomorrow. We're going to be talking about the NFL and about former Miami Dolphins head coach Brian Flores' suit against the NFL. He says that teams have performed sham interviews and that minority coaches are not getting a fair shot. So sports fans, what do you make of those allegations? And what about the NFL's so-called Rooney Rule that's aimed at promoting racial advancements in key leadership positions in the league? Has it been successful at all? So we want to hear from fans, even former players with coaching ambitions. What do you think about racial advancement and coaching positions and leadership positions in the NFL? That's what we're going to talk about tomorrow. I want to hear from you. 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we're trying to learn and understand what Ukrainian identity is, as Ukraine once again is at the heart of rising tensions between Russia, of course, and Ukraine and the West. And we're joined by Vitaly Chernetsky. He's a professor of Slavic languages and literature at the University of Kansas. Timothy Snyder joins us as well, history professor at Yale. And Sevgil Musayeva is with us. She's with us from the capital of Kyiv. She's editor of an online daily in Ukraine. And I just want to share with you something else that we learned over the past few days. We spoke with Hanna Hopko, former member of the Ukrainian parliament. She served as the head of its foreign affairs committee. And when she talked to us, she too was in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv.
During the Euromaidan, the dignity revolution, you could see at that time at Maidan representatives of different religious organizations, from Orthodox, Greek Catholics, Muslims, Jewish, standing together and demanding the European future of Ukraine. Now, the same you could see in the front line, different soldiers defending Ukraine, Russian-speaking, belonging to different religious organizations, but united by one idea, not to allow the aggressor state to take back Ukraine into the Russian sphere of influence.
And Hannah Hopko told us that today's Ukraine is very different from the Soviet Republic she was born into.
When I was born, Ukraine still was a hostage of Soviet Empire. So I was born in 1982, just almost 10 years before Ukraine restored its independence and renewed its statehood when Soviet Union collapsed.
And she says her country is now fighting to build a new pluralistic democracy, free of Russian influence.
We are fighting to see Ukraine truly independent, with strong institutions, with rule of law, and belonging to the European family. And also for me, because I'm from Western Ukraine. In Western Ukraine, the level of patriotism and also the recognition of your belongingness to Ukraine, your national identity, every time was very strong.
And Hopko believes that the support she's seeing from the West is crucial.
The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, during his visit to Kyiv, he also visited St. Sophia Cathedral, one of the most ancient in Ukraine. The St. Sophia Cathedral was built at the beginning of 11th century when Moscow didn't exist. So it's a powerful signal that Ukraine belongs to the most ancient nations at the European continent. Because Putin always tried to say that Ukraine is a failed state. Ukraine is an artificial state. And by visiting St. Sophia Cathedral, Boris Johnson actually, demolished all attempts of Russians and their propaganda, their disinformation campaigns against us.
That was Hannah Hopko, former member of the Ukrainian parliament, and she spoke with us from Kyiv. Sivgil, let me turn back to you. You two are in Kyiv now, and I should just ask, I mean, from our position here in the United States, seeing all the coverage of the, you know, the amassing of Russian troops, the flurry of diplomacy that's happening literally right now, I keep using the words tension. But what is it like on a day-to-day basis at the moment in Kyiv?
You know, when you live in war for the last 8 years, it was a little bit different that, for example, I received dozens of calls last 2 weeks from my friends at Harvard University in Washington, in different cities of the U.S., and they are more scared than we are. Because we live in this situation for the last 8 years, of course, we stressed about this, but we prepare as well. And I heard from my colleague from The Economist magazine phoned me, and he said that in Kremlin, they have opinion that maybe Ukraine will not fight because army is demoralized, etc. And I said, are you kidding me? It's not true. When something will happen tomorrow, dozens of thousands of people will do that. Even when we started this situation, a lot of my friends went to the some defense groups and signed in these defense groups. This is my
Well, Vitaly Chernetsky, I'd like to start bringing sort of all these threads together a little bit. We've talked about Ukrainian history, particularly over the past two centuries, ethnic, cultural, linguistic, religious factors in those history. But something that Hannah Hopko said really stuck in my mind. I mean, are we seeing the emergence of an authentic Ukrainian civic identity now, or is it a Ukrainian civic identity that's defined against the threat of Russian invasion? Do you see the difference there?
Yes, I think I do. What I would say that that Russian aggression was a catalyst and a factor in accelerating the processes, but it was not the defining factor. Because the whole point of Euromaidan, or the Revolution of Dignity, mm-hmm. as it is also known, in the winter of 13-14, was about sending a positive message. It was not a message against, but it was a message for seeing Ukraine united, for Ukraine making a choice of getting closer association with Europe. And this is something that many intellectuals, many analysts have emphasized, that while in the European Union, there is now a little bit of skepticism as to what the idea of the United Europe is, this idea became much stronger. And I guess Ukraine became one of the stronger carriers of those promises of that were so passionately advocated earlier in Europe, that they are still very strongly, and in fact more strongly than elsewhere, proclaimed and affirmed in Ukraine right now. So it is a positive identity. It's a freedom to, it's a choice to be, not to choice against someone else.
I see. Timothy Snyder, reflect on that. What would you add to that?
I think the word choice is extremely important. As I was listening to Sevgil Museeva speak, she said at one point it was my choice, and then talking about the referendum of 1991 on Ukrainian independence, she said it was a choice. A majority of people in Crimea, as well as in every single Ukrainian region, voted for independence in 1991. Then later she said it was my choice to join the political nation. This concept of choice is very important because it comes from the individual human being. It's an act as opposed to something which is declared by someone else. So it's very important for us to separate out this idea of a political nation, mm-hmm. a nation which is oriented towards a common future, from an ethnic nation. Because the idea of an ethnic nation is something that can be used by a dictator, right? So if you look at what Vladimir Putin is doing, he's saying, look, they speak Russian, therefore they're Russians, therefore I can tell them what to do, therefore I can invade their country. So the moment that you say some quote-unquote objective feature of a person makes them what they are, then power is ceded to a distant dictator. But when we recognize that nations are made by common efforts, which are directed towards a future, then suddenly the world is much more interesting and also, of course, much more plausible. Because after all, you know, Meghna, you and I, we're not English because we're speaking English. Mm-hmm. Our political identities have to do with choices that we've made, choices that our families have made. And in that sense, Ukraine, again, it's normal, just more so. I tend to think that Ukraine is actually pointing the way towards a plausible 21st century notion of what a nation could actually be.
Oh, isn't that fascinating? Sevgil, what do you think about that?
You know, I think that first force vacancies happened in 2004 during Orange Revolution. And mm-hmm. I was just 18 years old. I was a student in the Institute of Journalism. And I remember this moment. But in 2014, it was just force vacancies. But in 2014, during Revolution of Dignity, we did a civilization choice. And we voted for European future of our nation and actually paid a huge price. And now it's February, and I do remember February in 2014. I remember the smell of firewood melted in the barrel, the smoke of tires that covered all around. I remember how it feels when pepper gas gets into your face and how quickly you should run. When police started move on. And I remember the morning, for example, of morning, it was February 20. I lived almost on Maidan, and I woke up and the smoke was all over the square. I took that picture and then went to look up what's going on. And already 8 protesters were shot dead on Maidan during this time. And I think that a lot of people of my age in Ukraine remember this moment. And it was a clear moment of burning of political nation, first of all.
Well, we've just got about 5 minutes left in the conversation. These go by so quickly, I have to say. Vitaly Chernetsky, you know, we have the three of you have helped form a picture in our minds of this unified Ukrainian civic identity, at least, one that's being crafted by choice, as we hear. But certainly there have to be internal conflicts and tension. Not every Ukrainian is unified here. Are they?
Well, as with every country, there are regional differences, there are political differences, there are ethno-cultural differences, but just like in this country, in the United States, we think of our diversity as a source of our strength. We should approach Ukraine in the same way. Yes, Ukraine is a diverse place, but this is good. This is, means that this diverse group of people chooses to understand and mind those differences, but despite them, to come together in this conscious choice that they are making.
Do you think that those, I'm asking this again from a squarely American point of view right now, given the state of this country at the moment, right? That do you think those differences, those ethnic, cultural, political differences down the road could threaten the Ukrainian solidarity that we're talking about now?
Well, Ukraine is a place with a history of not being a very sort of centralized, top-down place. On the contrary, in some periods of its history, there is like almost like anarchic disarray. I mean, we should remember that the only attempt at and creating an anarchist state under Nestor Makhno in during the years of the revolution, 1917-1920, was in Ukraine. But somehow Ukraine has been able to overcome this internal strife and clashes towards the future. It's not a simple road, but I think the will, the determination is there.
Mm. Timothy Snyder, pick up on that and feel free to answer that same question. But and in addition, though, I also want to know, how do you think this Ukrainian identity, as we've been talking about today, might inform what could happen there between Russia and Ukraine in the coming even weeks and months?
I mean, I would prefer to land on the positive. I mean, what I've really liked about this conversation is that it's helped filled out what Ukraine is, mm-hmm. as opposed to what people outside Ukraine who are hostile to Ukraine say about it. I think it's just very important to recognize that here we have a country where the president is bilingual, you know, where the country's bilingual, the capital's bilingual. The president of Ukraine represents a traditionally oppressed ethnic minority. In this case, it happens to be the Jews. We're looking at a country where there are all kinds of differences, but the diversity is very real in politics, and the country is being held together by a kind of civic identity. This leads to a basic misunderstanding sometimes in Russia about what Ukraine is, but it also leads to a certain amount of disquiet, I think, for people like Mr. Putin, who don't want the world to run in this way. They don't want there to be messy democracies. He wants there to be a clear authoritarian line where the dictator gets to say who you are. And so I can't predict what's going to happen, but I do think what we've talked about today helps us to understand why Mr. Putin fundamentally misunderstands certain things.
Mm. Well, Sivgil, we have 30 seconds left. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you the last word. What would you like Americans to know right now about Ukraine? The most important thing.
Okay. It's so hard. And you told me that it's just 30 minutes.
30 seconds, yes.
I think that our national idea is about with honor to our past and with a big hope for our future. Mm. And big hope for our future, I think that it's answer for my question.
Yeah.
Well, we believe that everything will be fine with us.
Well, Sevgil Musayeva, editor of the online daily Ukrainska Pravda, joining us today from Kyiv. Thank you so much for being on the show, Sevgil.
Thank you.
And Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale, author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, and also On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, amongst many other titles. Professor Snyder, it's always great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Vitaly Chernetsky, professor of Slavic languages and literature at the University of Kansas, author of Spaces of Glocalization, Studies in Ukrainian Literature and Cinema. That's coming out soon. He's also author of Mapping Post-Communist Cultures, Russia and Ukraine in the Context of Globalization. Professor Chernetsky, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.